Imagine a missile the size of a railroad locomotive traveling at treetop level at 3 times the speed of sound. It can't be detected in advance, it can't be shot down. Its superheated shockwave breaks windows and scorches the earth along its path, while radioactive fallout spewing from its nuclear engine turns whatever is left into an irradiated wasteland. And when the hellish weapon finally reaches its destination, it unleashes a payload of 26 10-megaton thermonuclear warheads, more than 5,000 times the explosive power of the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, while this sounds like a nightmarish scenario straight out of science fiction, in the early 1960s it came terrifyingly close to becoming a reality and pushing humanity all the closer to the brink of Armageddon. This is the forgotten story of SLAM, America's Cold War nuclear-powered doomsday missile. Our story begins in the mid-1950s. For the first decade and a half of the Cold War, the only practical means of delivering nuclear weapons to their targets was via manned strategic bombers like the American B-47 Stratojet and the B-52 Stratofortress, the British V-bombers, the Avro Vulcan, Handley Page Victor and Vickers Valiant, or the Soviet Tupolev Tu-95 Bear and Myasishchev M-4 Bison. However, such aircraft had numerous shortcomings, their relatively slow speed and vast distances between the US and the Soviet Union giving ample warning of their arrival and making them highly vulnerable to manned interceptor aircraft and guided surface-to-air missiles. Indeed, by the mid-1950s, both sides had developed sophisticated aerial defense systems that made it unlikely that many bombers would actually get through to their targets. In response, a variety of sophisticated supersonic bombers like the North American XB-70 Valkyrie, Convair B-58 Hustler, British Aircraft Corporation TSR-2, and Myasishchev M-50 Bounder all were developed to outrun, outclimb, outmaneuver, and outsmart these aerial defenses. But rapid advances in radar and missile technology soon rendered even these ineffective. Another major problem with manned bombers was endurance. Aircraft eventually need to land in order to refuel and undergo maintenance, and this rendered airfields and their nuclear arsenals vulnerable to preemptive counterforce first strike. One solution was to use mid-air refueling. Indeed, from 1960 to 1968, the United States Air Force's Strategic Command carried out a continuous airborne alert program called Operation Chrome Dome, wherein up to 12 nuclear-armed B-52 Stratofortress bombers were kept in the air at all times. These aircraft flew long-range patrol routes that took them from bases in the continental United States to the borders of the Soviet Union and back, supported by a global network of tanker aircraft. This way, even if the rest of the United States nuclear arsenal was destroyed in a surprise Soviet attack, at least a few warheads would remain intact, allowing SAC to maintain second strike capability and preserve the delicate balance of mutually assured destruction, or MAD. However, the length of airborne alert missions were still limited by the endurance of their crews, who could only be expected to remain alert and combat effective for 24 straight hours. Both the United States and Soviet Union thus turned to a radical new technology, airborne nuclear propulsion. This involved fitting large manned bombers like the Convair B-36 Peacemaker and Tupolev Tu-95 Bear with compact nuclear reactors, whose heat was used in place of burning fuel to drive specially modified jet engines. Such propulsion systems would, it was hoped, allow nuclear-armed bombers to remain in the air for weeks or even months at a time, their crews taking rest shifts in order to maintain continuous combat readiness. However, test flights revealed a slight problem. The reactors produced so much radiation that the weight of the shielding needed to protect the crew approximately equaled the aircraft's bomb load. Thus, while nuclear-powered aircraft were technically feasible, they would be unable to carry any sort of useful payload. The Soviets attempted to solve this problem in the most Soviet fashion possible by removing the shielding altogether and assigning only their oldest crews to fly the aircraft. As the brutal logic went, these individuals had already sired children and thus made their contribution to Soviet society. So if the searing radiation from the reactor ended up sterilizing or killing them, niet problem, comrade. Thankfully, however, both the American and the Soviet programs were cancelled in the early 1960s after only a handful of test flights with the reactor unconnected to the engines, and thus far no manned aircraft has ever flown under nuclear power. Meanwhile, both sides of the conflict deployed a variety of medium-range ballistic missiles, or MRBMs, like the American PGM-19 Jupiter and the PGM-17A Thor, capable of delivering a nuclear warhead from the edge of space at several times the speed of sound. Unlike manned bombers, such missiles were impossible to intercept and shoot down. However, they also needed to be sighted close to their targets, with the US Air Force deploying the Jupiter in Turkey and Italy and the Thor in the UK. Indeed, tensions over the sitting of Soviet R-12 Dvina MRBMs in Cuba would later trigger the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. While larger intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, capable of reaching the Soviet Union from the United States and vice versa, were being investigated, given the primitive state of propulsion and guidance technology, it was not at all certain whether such weapons could be made powerful or accurate enough to be effective. Then, in 1956, the US Air Force came up with a bold and rather terrifying proposal. Instead of a manned bomber, why not build a nuclear-powered cruise missile? Getting rid of the crew eliminated the need for heavy shielding, allowing the airframe to be lighter, faster, and carry a heavier payload, while the more conventional flight profile allowed for the use of existing aircraft guidance technology. Also, unlike ballistic missiles, such a weapon could be recalled from its mission at the last minute. Dubbed the Supersonic Low Altitude Missile, or SLAM, after launch, the missile would circle over the ocean at high altitude, its nuclear power plant allowing it to stay aloft for days at a time. Then, when commanded to attack, it would drop down to treetop level and dash towards the Soviet Union at Mach 3, around 3,700 kilometers per hour, its speed and altitude making it all but impossible to track and shoot down. Using terrain-following radar and an inertial navigation system, it would fly a pre-programmed course across the countryside, destroying pre-selected targets with a payload of up to 16 10-megaton thermonuclear warheads. Unit cost was estimated at around $5 million, that's $39 million today, far cheaper than a manned bomber like a B-52 Stratofortress, while operating costs would be less than those of a bomber or ballistic missile submarine. It was, in short, the ultimate doomsday weapon. Now, the basic concept had already been investigated between 1954 and 1955 by engineers Frank Rom and Eldon Dams of the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, or NACA. That's the direct ancestor of NASA, by the way, and indeed, it was found to be feasible. At the same time, the Atomic Energy Commission, or AEC, was investigating the use of nuclear-powered rocket engines in the upper stages of ICBMs and spacecraft launch vehicles. This would eventually spawn two related research programs: Project Rover, a nuclear engine for rocket vehicle application, or NERVA. That's a subject for another video. In any case, on January 1st, 1957, the Air Force and the AEC officially approved SLAM and issued System Requirement, or SR No. 149, for its development. Design of the engine was assigned to the Marquardt Corporation, and the nuclear reactor to power said engine to the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory, today the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, while three major aircraft manufacturers, Chanceforte Aircraft, North American Aviation, and Consolidated Volte, or Convair, were invited to submit proposals for the missile airframe and guidance system. The contract was ultimately awarded to the Chanceforte team under Dr. Walter Hess. The reactor development program, directed by Livermore engineer Theodore Merkel, was codenamed Project Pluto, after the Roman god of the underworld. This is not to be confused with Operation Pluto, aka Pipeline Under the Ocean, the Second World War project to pump oil across the English Channel in support of the D-Day landings, which we've actually done a video on before, by the way. Now, to say that Merkel's team at Livermore had their work cut out for them would be a massive understatement, for the technical requirements of Project Pluto strained the boundaries of 1950s nuclear engineering and material science to their very limits. Indeed, as Merkel himself stated in his preliminary report, quoting here, "Pluto includes 10 major research and development areas which must be entered if one wishes to actually produce such an engine," end quote. The engines used in the Soviet and American nuclear bomber projects worked very much like regular turbojet engines. Air was drawn in at the front, it was compressed, it was heated, and expelled out the rear to generate thrust, with a portion being passed through a turbine to power the compressor. And to learn more about the history and technology of this cornerstone of modern aviation, please do check out our previous video, Who Invented the Jet Engine? Now, the main difference was that instead of burning fuel, the heat was generated by a nuclear reactor. There were two main designs investigated. In a direct cycle engine, air passes directly from the compressor to the reactor, picks up heat from the core, and then is exhausted through the turbine. But while lighter and simpler, this arrangement had a nasty habit of spewing out large volumes of radioactive air and particles from the reactor core, which isn't brilliant. This was somewhat alleviated through the use of an indirect cycle, which used two separate loops of cooling air, a primary loop that absorbed heat from the reactor and transferred it through a heat exchanger to the air flowing through the engine. As the primary loop was sealed, less radiation leaked out of the system, though at the cost of greater weight and less thermal efficiency. However, the propulsion system for Project Pluto was significantly simpler, taking the form of a nuclear ramjet engine. Now, ramjets work just like regular jet engines, taking in, compressing, heating, and expelling air, but they have no moving parts like compressors and turbines. Instead, the air is compressed by the movement of the engine through the air. As such, ramjets cannot work at zero or low air speeds and must be boosted to working speed by another rocket or jet engine. Preliminary calculations revealed that the optimum thrust coefficient, that is, the difference between the thrust generated by the ramjet and the aerodynamic drag that it produces, would be achieved at speeds of between Mach 2.5 and 3, or around 3,700 kilometers per hour at sea level, and a maximum reactor core temperature of 2,000 degrees Celsius. This would not only subject the engine to pressures and temperatures exceeding the melting point and yield strength of steel, but also intense neutron and gamma radiation whose effects on common aerospace materials were poorly understood. And the whole thing also had to be made light and compact enough to fly. It was a daunting challenge, but one which the scientists and engineers at Livermore relished, for it was, in the words of the father of the atomic bomb, J. Robert Oppenheimer, technically sweet. The first major task was to decide what form the reactor should take. All reactors work by exploiting the nuclear chain reaction. When a subatomic particle called a neutron strikes the nucleus of a fissile isotope, like uranium-235, it is sometimes absorbed and causes the nucleus to split apart, or fission, into multiple fragments called fission products, as well as one or more neutrons, which can then go on to fission more uranium nuclei and release more neutrons, and so on and so forth. If the average number of neutrons produced by each generation of fissions remains at one or higher, then the reaction is said to be self-sustaining and the nuclear assembly critical. The likelihood that a fissile nucleus will absorb a neutron and fission, i.e. its neutron cross-section, is dependent on the energy or temperature of the neutron, with the highest probability occurring at around 0.025 electron volts. However, the neutrons produced by nuclear fission are of the higher energy or fast variety that are unlikely to trigger further fissions. As a result, most nuclear reactors place a material called a moderator between the uranium fuel elements to slow the fast neutrons into lower energy thermal neutrons. Many different materials have traditionally been used as moderators, including graphite, regular light water, and heavy water, i.e. water where at least one hydrogen atom has been replaced by the heavy isotope deuterium. Now, it is possible to build a reactor without a moderator that uses only fast neutrons, known rather uncreatively as a fast reactor. However, due to the lower probability of fissions, far more fuel is needed in order to attain a critical mass, making the reactor too heavy to fly. A moderated reactor was thus the only option. But this created further problems, such as how to minimize the volume and weight of the moderator. Also, while uranium oxide commonly used in reactor fuel is highly heat resistant, at the high temperatures encountered in the Pluto reactor, it would convert into less stable triuranium octoxide and disintegrate on contact with oxygen. The fuel thus had to be prevented from coming into direct contact with the air flowing through the reactor. One method of solving both problems was to blend the fuel and moderator into a single material, creating a so-called homogeneous reactor. This is in contrast to a typical heterogeneous reactor in which the fuel and moderator are separate. But what to use as a moderator? Graphite? That was out of the question, for it too would oxidize and erode at high temperatures. This left only high temperature or refractory ceramics, namely silicon carbide and beryllium oxide. And since the latter is a significantly more efficient neutron moderator than the former, it was the material ultimately chosen. The finalized fuel material, nicknamed horseradish by the Livermore engineers, consisted of uranium oxide enriched to 93.2% uranium-235, mixed with beryllium oxide, zirconium oxide, and yttrium oxide, with the latter two ingredients designed to stabilize the uranium oxide and prevent it from transitioning into a less stable phase. Now, this in turn was extruded into hundreds of pencil-like hexagonal fuel elements, each 7.5 millimeters wide and 100 millimeters long, with a cylindrical air channel running down the middle. These were packed together in a tight honeycomb structure held together by end plates and tie rods made of heat-resistant nickel superalloys called Rene-31 and Hastelloy R-235. This construction method gave the fuel elements room to expand when heated, preventing the reactor from buckling under thermal stress. Despite the high-temperature materials employed, however, the tolerances for Project Pluto remained precariously tight. At full power, the tie plates and rods would be only 150 degrees away from their auto-ignition temperature, the point at which they would spontaneously ignite on contact with air. Interestingly, ceramics manufacturing for Project Pluto was undertaken by the Coors Porcelain Company of Golden, Colorado. And if that name sounds familiar to you, that's because the company was founded in 1887 by Adolf Coors to produce beer bottles and ceramic fermentation vats for his brewery, which still operates to this day. This work was extremely hazardous, not only due to the extreme toxicity of beryllium, but the presence of highly enriched uranium. special mixing and extrusion machinery had to be designed to prevent the fuel slurry from achieving criticality by shape and accidentally undergoing a nuclear chain reaction. That'd be bad. Now, the first reactor prototype, dubbed Torii 2A, was completed in mid-1960. To simplify the testing process, Torii 2A was only a third of the size of the projected flight-capable reactor and was water instead of air-cooled. The reactor was surrounded on all sides by beryllium oxide reflectors to bounce neutrons back into the core and maintain criticality, while reactivity was controlled by 14 neutron-absorbing hafnium control rods which moved linearly inside the hollow tie rods. 12 of these were shim rods used to adjust heat distribution across the core, while the remaining two were used for coarse and fine adjustment of overall reactivity. Now, normally, these moved at 7.2 centimeters per second, but in the case of a rapid shutdown, or scram, they could be fully inserted in only 1.5 seconds. However, overall control of the reactor was achieved using special drums, or vanes, mounted outside the core, coated on one side with neutron-reflecting beryllium oxide and on the other with neutron-absorbing boron. By rotating these drums to various angles, the total number of neutrons reflected back into the core, and thus the overall reactivity, could be adjusted. Adding to the already enormous challenges facing the Pluto team, the pneumatic motors used to actuate the control rods and vanes had to be specially engineered to operate reliably in the intense heat, neutron, and gamma flux inside the core. Meanwhile, a dedicated test facility was constructed at Site 401 in the Nevada desert site on a desolate patch of sagebrush scrub known as Jackass Flats. As ramjets cannot operate at zero airspeed, air instead had to be passed through the stationary Pluto engine at supersonic speeds. This was achieved by welding together some 40 kilometers of 25 centimeter diameter oil well casing to create a tank farm capable of storing some 540 metric tons of compressed air at a pressure of 25 megapascal. Despite the Pluto team borrowing three giant compressors from the US Navy's New London submarine base at Groton, Connecticut, it still took 5 days to fully pressurize this reservoir for a 5-minute full power test. Due to compression heating, at full operational speed, air would enter the SLAM missile's engine intake at a blistering temperature of 730 degrees Celsius. To replicate this, air exiting the tank farm was first passed through giant tanks containing 14 million 2.5-centimeter steel balls heated by gas burners before entering the test engine. But the test stand and its tank farm were just one part of the whole Pluto test facility. To allow the intensely radioactive engines to be safely dismantled and inspected following a test, a special disassembly structure known as Building 2201 was constructed. This featured concrete walls 2.5 meters thick with 1.25 meter thick lead glass viewing windows through which operators could inspect and manipulate the engines using remotely operated robotic arms. Engines were shuttled between the test stand and Building 2201 on flat cars running along a set of tracks jokingly dubbed the Jackass and Western Railroad. Two locomotives were built for this purpose, L1, which was electrically powered and remotely driven, and L2, a backup manned diesel-electric unit with lead shielding built around the cab to protect the operator. Building 2201 also contained workshops, photographic laboratories, maintenance shops for the railway cars, locomotives and other equipment, offices, storage facilities, and the control room for engine tests. This contained television screens for viewing the engines remotely and was fitted with a filtered positive pressure ventilation system to keep out radioactive fallout. It also featured an underground fallout shelter with 2 weeks' worth of supplies in case of a truly catastrophic radiation incident. The entire facility, which covered 21 square kilometers and included over 10 kilometers of specially built roads, was built for $1.2 million, about $9 million in today's money. The Torii 2A prototype was transported to Jackass Flats in mid-1960 and assembled in Building 2201 for a series of preliminary tests, first achieving criticality on October the 7th. To test the overall reactivity of the core, engineers pumped regular water coolant through the core and attempted to start up the reactor. But despite turning the control vanes a full 180 degrees, the reactor failed to achieve criticality. The engineers replaced the light water with heavy water, which has a lower neutron cross-section, and this time the reactor successfully achieved criticality, but only after the vanes were rotated 65 degrees. It was thus decided to add another layer of fuel elements to the core to increase the reactor's fuel load and margin of error. In this configuration, Torii 2A was successfully run at 150 watts for 10 minutes. Yet despite this progress, the test program constantly threw up unexpected challenges, which required unusual and often ingenious solutions to overcome. For example, after trying all manner of exotic coatings to protect electric motor armatures from the extreme heat of the reactor, one engineer hit upon the idea of using ordinary automotive exhaust manifold paint obtained through, of all places, an ad in Hot Rod magazine. Similarly, while assembling the reactor, various support springs were temporarily held open using ordinary mothballs, which evaporated once their purpose was served. Far trickier to solve was the annoying tendency of heat-sensing thermocouples to burn up during reactor tests. However, engineer Richard Werner developed a clever method of measuring temperature by comparing film footage of the operating reactor with a temperature-calibrated color scale. Further tests were conducted to determine how the reactor would stand up to extreme vibration and air pressure under flight conditions, with the airflow through the engine being steadily increased from 27 to 34, 45, 150, and 330 kilograms per second. While Tori 2A passed those tests with flying colors, during its last qualification test on January 11, 1961, a clamp holding the nozzle to the engine broke, sending the nozzle flying 150 meters through the air. Shortly thereafter, a test of the automatic coupling system between the locomotive and engine flat car went awry when the coupling unexpectedly released, sending the flat car careening down a hill and into the wall of a test pad bunker. Whoops-a-daisy. This incident severely damaged the railcar and reactor, forcing both to be completely stripped down and rebuilt. Finally, with all the kinks ironed out, the Pluto team mounted Tori 2A on the automatic railcar and sent it trundling toward the test stand. On the afternoon of May 14, 1961, the valves on the tank farm were opened and the nuclear ramjet roared to life. The engineers cheered as the test instruments returned their results. Tori 2 had operated for a few seconds at 46 megawatts, reaching a maximum core temperature of 1,420 degrees Celsius. But it had worked, proving that the nuclear ramjet principle was feasible. To celebrate their success, Ted Merkel and his team liberated a piano from a nearby woman's dormitory, mounted it on a flatbed truck, and drove it to the nearby town of Mercury, Nevada, singing bawdy songs all the way. They spent the night in the local saloon, returning to the test site the following morning, satisfied but oh so very hungover. Three more full power runs were conducted on September the 28th, October 5th, and October 6th, reaching maximum power levels of 144, 166, and 162 megawatts, respectively. With the test series concluded, Tori 2A was dismantled for inspection, and work immediately began on a larger, more powerful engine called Tori 2B. However, the success of Tori 2A persuaded the Pluto team to skip this intermediate step and proceed directly to a full-scale prototype, Tori 2C. This reactor had a core measuring 145 centimeters in diameter and 127 centimeters long, composed of 465,000 fuel elements containing 60 kilograms of uranium. Its rated power output was 600 megawatts, theoretically allowing it to propel the SLAM missile to a top speed of Mach 3. However, contrary to what is often reported, its endurance would not be unlimited. According to Merkel's calculations, it would take around 1 gram of uranium to generate 1 megawatt day of energy, meaning the Tori 2C would consume around 1% of its fuel every day. It would thus be able to stay aloft for a few days before its total fuel load fell below critical mass. Nor was the missile as dirty as its flying Chernobyl reputation might suggest. At most, Merkel estimated, SLAM would produce around 100 grams of radioactive material per mission, which would be widely dispersed along its flight path. Furthermore, Merkel wrote, quote, "The reactor radiations, while intense, do not lead to problems with personnel who happen to be under such a power plant passing overhead at flight speed, even for very low altitudes. Also, in launching such a device, the reactor can be brought up to power using the boosting phase so that the personnel near the launching point need not be exposed to excessive radiation, even though unprotected." End quote. Of course, if the missile malfunctioned en route or was deliberately crashed at the end of its mission, the fallout from the disintegrating reactor would be extensive. However, given that the missile would have just finished delivering up to 26 thermonuclear warheads, I suppose this would be the least of the recipient's problems, wouldn't it? Construction of Tori 2C proceeded so swiftly that by the time the engine arrived at Jackass Flats in mid-November, the test facilities were not yet ready to receive it. Most of the preliminary tests on the reactor were thus conducted in support of facilities' checkout operations, for example, testing the air supply and engine flat cars and training test operators. This process took a full 16 months, ending on March 5, 1964, after 82 separate tests had been carried out. These were followed by a number of preliminary tests carried out on the test stand. For example, on March 23rd, engineers confirmed that the six electrically actuated auxiliary shutdown rods could be safely removed from the reactor so long as the six manually inserted rods were in place. This helped streamline operations by preventing test personnel from having to be evacuated during final checkout procedures. This was then followed by a series of low-power runs at airflow rates of up to 816 kilograms per second. Well, the first such test on April the 9th ended prematurely when the reactor was automatically scrammed. This was traced to a faulty vibration transducer, and all subsequent tests proceeded without incident. On May the 7th, a low-power test at 454 degrees Celsius and 820 kilograms per second also ended in a scram when a number of shimrod actuators malfunctioned, but this too was traced to a minor fault, in this case a loose wire and faulty pressure switch. With the error corrected, on May the 12th, the Pluto team conducted an intermediate power test at 1,242 degrees Celsius and 570 kilograms per second, simulating flight conditions at Mach 2.8 at an altitude of 3,000 meters. The reactor ran perfectly for an hour and 45 minutes before being shut down. Finally, on May the 20th, 1964, nearly 3 years to the day after the first successful test of Tori 2A, Tori 2C was finally operated under full flight conditions. During the test, which lasted 292 seconds, the limit for the tank farm, the intake overflow reached 754 kilograms per second at a core temperature of 1,242 degrees C, simulating a speed of Mach 2.8 at sea level. Power outputs were measured at 461 megawatts. A week later, the engine was run again at 513 megawatts, generating 156 kilonewtons of thrust. The test, witnessed by dozens of observers from the Air Force and AEC, demonstrated once again the magnitude of Livermore's engineering achievements and the surprising feasibility of the SLAM concept. Meanwhile, at Chance Fort Aircraft in Dallas, Texas, design work on the SLAM airframe was well underway. As with the reactor, the engineering challenges were enormous, for at the time, no one had designed a vehicle that could withstand the intense heat and aerodynamic forces of Mach 3 flight at sea level. Over 1,600 hours of wind tunnel testing at various laboratories across the country were required to refine the final design, a wingless, needle-shaped vehicle 27 meters long and weighing 27.5 metric tons. Three fins at the rear provided stability, while small canards on the nose were used for steering. Air entered the nuclear ramjet through a scoop-shaped inlet on the missile's nose and was expelled out of a nozzle in the rear. SLAM's fuselage, constructed of thick panels of Rene 41 alloy, was extremely robust, earning the missile the nickname of the Flying Crowbar. Several deployment schemes were proposed for SLAM, including air launch from a modified B-52 Stratofortress bomber. However, the most likely plan would have involved basing the missiles in special hardened concrete shelters and launching them using strap-on solid rocket boosters, which would accelerate them to the speed needed for the nuclear ramjet to take over. Once launched, the missiles would be steered towards their targets by an automatic guidance system called TERCOM. Short for Terrain Contour Matching, TERCOM takes terrain elevation and measurements from the missile's ground-scanning radar and continuously compares it to a large stored digital map. Discrepancies between the two datasets are translated into course corrections. Being independent of any ground facility and relying solely on large-scale physical geography, which is very difficult to alter, TERCOM is impossible to jam and is not easily fooled by snow, buildings, and other visual distractions. And for these and many other reasons, more advanced versions are still used in cruise missiles today. Originally, Chanceport had planned to use an inertial navigation system, or INS, which uses a set of gyroscopes and accelerometers to track an aircraft or missile's movement through 3D space, but unfortunately, no existing system was capable of withstanding the intense radiation emitted by the nuclear ramjet engine. Indeed, every single electronic component aboard SLAM had to be carefully selected, modified, or designed from scratch and rigorously tested in an Air Force radiation chamber to ensure that it could survive this harsh operating environment. The TERCOM system allowed multiple targets to be programmed into the missile's flight path, each of which could be attacked using one or more of the missile's 26 thermonuclear warheads. These were designed to be ejected vertically through hatches on the top of the vehicle, imparting a high ballistic trajectory that would give SLAM just enough time to escape its own warhead's detonation. But just when all of SLAM's components were starting to come together, the whole project suddenly found itself on the government's chopping block. In early 1964, the AEC requested a further $8 million, around $60 million today, from Congress for the fiscal year 1965 to continue development of the Tori 2C and even more refined Tori 3 reactors. However, in April of that year, the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy recommended cutting $1.5 million from this amount and potentially scrapping Project Pluto altogether. There were several reasons for this sudden scrutiny. For one thing, the Pluto team was now confronted with an awkward problem it had thus far managed to avoid: how to flight test a nuclear-powered cruise missile. Testing over Nevada was immediately ruled out. There was simply too much risk of a prototype missile running amok and crashing into a populated area, triggering a major radiological incident. A bizarre idea was even floated to fly missiles in circles on the end of a very long tether, but this too was quickly rejected. The only remotely feasible proposal was to fly the missiles over the South Pacific near a US possession like Wake Island, crashing them into a deep ocean trench at the end of each test flight. However, even in the carefree NUCAPI days of the early 1960s, the AEC was hesitant to sign off on such egregious pollution of the ocean. As a result, Congress gave the US Air Force an extremely tight deadline of July 1, 1964 to present a satisfactory flight test program. Such bureaucratic, hand-wringing, irritated project director Ted Merkle emphasized to Congress that SLAM was 100% feasible and could be made operational by the end of the decade. To quote him, "It is just a question of do you want it or not." However, even if a means could be found to safely flight test SLAM, there were other objections against the Doomsday Missile. For example, by geographic necessity, SLAM would have to pass over fellow NATO countries on its way to the Soviet Union, its powerful superheated shockwave and deafening 150 decibel noise signature wreaking chaos and destruction all along its flight path. For comparison, the maximum noise signature of the Saturn V rocket that sent astronauts to the moon was 200 decibels. And if the missile accidentally went off course or crashed en route, the damage inflicted to allied nations could be disastrous. Furthermore, US military planners feared that a missile as horrifying as SLAM would be too provocative, goading the Soviets into developing a similar weapon and further escalating the Cold War arms race. But perhaps the biggest strike against SLAM was that it was simply obsolete. Accurate ICBMs proved far easier to build than initially feared, and by 1964, the US Air Force had deployed a large arsenal of Atlas, Titan II, and Minuteman missiles. And the US Navy, which had originally planned to deploy SLAM aboard its submarines, quickly lost interest after the Polaris Submarine Launched Ballistic Missile, or SLBM, entered service in 1961. When originally conceived in 1956, SLAM would have been all but immune to Soviet air defenses. By 1964, however, improvements in radar and surface-to-air missile technology meant that this was no longer the case. Despite its blistering speed, SLAM was still slower and more vulnerable than an ICBM or SLBM, leading critics to joke that SLAM stood for slow, low, and messy. As a result, on July 1, 1964, the House Appropriations Committee slashed a further $5.5 million from the Project Pluto budget, leaving only $1 million to cover decommissioning. 7 years after it was originally approved, SLAM was dead. The Tory 2C reactor remained at Jackass Flats until 1976, when it was finally dismantled and its radioactive components carted away for disposal. Meanwhile, Building 2201 was used for various classified nuclear projects until 2013, when it was finally demolished. Beginning to end, the ambitious, cutting-edge project had cost around $260 million, that's around $2 billion today, and employed around 600 people at Livermore, Vought, and Marquardt. But while no flying missile was ultimately produced, the project did yield numerous advances in materials technology, radiation-hardened electronics, and guidance systems like TERCOM. Following the project's cancellation, Ted Merkle gathered his engineers at a local country club for a last supper, which he handed out commemorative tie tacks and bottles of Pluto mineral water. The atmosphere was bittersweet. As chemist William Moran, who oversaw the production of the ceramic fuel elements, later stated, "It was the best 6 years of my life." Meanwhile, engineer Chuck Barnett, who directed the Tory tests at Jackass Flats, summed up the irresistible appeal of the project. Quote, "I was young, we had lots of money, it was very exciting." Indeed, SLAM and Project Pluto are the sort of bonkers, existentially horrifying projects that could have only have come out of the early Cold War period, when the atom was our friend and no proposal was too crazy in the fight against communism. Thankfully, however, we've since come to our senses and realized that a nuclear-powered cruise missile is an objectively bad idea. Right? Right? Well, no, apparently not. For an August 9th, 2019, Russian nuclear energy agency Rosatom reported that a radiological accident had taken place at the State Central Navy Testing Range in Arkhangelsk Oblast. The incident, it claimed, was related to tests of a nuclear-powered cruise missile called the 9M730 Burevestnik, or Storm Petrel. While details of this new weapon are scarce, the design seemed to be motivated by the same advances that inspired SLAM 60 years before: long range, high endurance, sheer intimidation. Disturbingly, what applies to endless sequels, reboots, and spin-offs of classic media franchises apparently also applies to Cold War Doomsday missiles. Everything old is new again.